KOWA 106.5 LPFM presents an interview with the 22nd Cuba Caravanistas. This is a KOWA 106.5 LPFM production. This grassroots media collaboration is sponsored by Pastors for Peace, IPCO, Media Island International, KOWA 106.5 LPFM, and the Wednesday Media Group. It is KOWA 106.5 LPFM's pleasure to introduce members of the Cuba Caravan. Welcome to Olympia. Please introduce yourselves and tell us why you are undertaking this venture.
Hi, my name's Janine Solanke, and I'm from Vancouver, Canada. I work there with a group called Vancouver Communities in Solidarity with Cuba. And here right beside me is...
Hap Buckley. I live in Kitsap County and Seattle, Washington State. Yeah, we're about to take off on the 22nd Pastors for Peace caravan to Cuba.
Right now we're in Olympia, and we're going to go all down the West Coast to Texas, through Mexico, and on to Cuba with humanitarian aid destined for Cuba, with U.S. citizens that are going to Cuba without a license to openly defy and break the U.S. blockade on Cuba.
We'll be one of 13 legs of the total caravan that begin in the northern United States and Canada, extending the width of the continent, and then heading south, stopping at towns and cities and communities along the way, picking up all kinds of donated aid, construction supplies, computers, soccer balls, textbooks, pencils, and all kinds of things, art supplies.
I'm from Canada, and basically I could just travel to Cuba with no problem at all. Last year there was about 1 million tourists from Canada that traveled to Cuba, so it's a huge destination travel spot for Canadians. I kind of decided after seeing Cuba myself a couple of times that I wanted to get involved in doing something that actually was constructive in breaking the U.S. blockade on Cuba. Being able to travel through the United States and tell people about my experiences and what I've seen and learned in Cuba, because I'm able to go without any problem to see it myself, and give U.S. citizens that I meet along the way a kind of picture of that so that they're able to get a picture that's not the mainstream media and lies about Cuba. That's something I really wanted to do. This is the second year I'm going on the caravan, and that's kind of why I decided to get involved and be a part of this project. But what about you, Hap?
Yeah, it's obviously a little more complicated for United States citizens to go to Cuba, although we legally can do it. The laws kind of fluctuate. Sometimes they tighten them down, sometimes they loosen up. Basically, we're not supposed to go and spend any money there, which pretty much makes travel to Cuba impossible. But with Pastors for Peace, it's a lot like Rosa Parks. She sat down at the front of the bus. She didn't try to pass as a white lady. She didn't try to hide under the seat and get away with something. She just sat there and said, no, I'm sitting here and I'm going to do what I need to do against this unethical, evil law. It was a law. She was breaking that law, and that's what we do. We cross the border. We don't get any kind of permission or consent or permit to do what we do because it's an act of civil disobedience.
Yeah, and I think that the act of civil disobedience is a really important part of the caravan. And also we're doing it with so many people that come together from so many different backgrounds all across the United States. There's about 100 people going this year, and that's mainly from the United States, but also people from Canada, Germany, England, who are a part of this project to challenge the U.S. trade and travel blockade on Cuba.
The whole reason that Pastors for Peace, the genesis of it, why it came into existence, was as a response to this blockade that was imposed by Washington, D.C. It's an act of war that the United States is imposing on the people of Cuba.
I think a big part of the caravan also is the educational aspect. Every single night we are stopping in a different city. There's an event hosted in each city about the caravan, about the blockade on Cuba, where we have a chance to talk to people, some who know a lot about Cuba and some who can't even find it on a map. We really learn a lot ourselves. about the lies really that have been perpetrated by mass media and the government here in the United States about what Cuba is. We have that amazing opportunity to talk to people in 130 different cities across the United States. A lot of people know there's a blockade on Cuba, but don't know exactly how all-encompassing this blockade is. It's not just that they can't trade with Cuba. People might say, oh, well, why don't they just trade with a different country? There's a couple of main things about the blockade that make it very difficult for Cuba to import or export goods. For example, any ship that docks in a Cuban port can't dock in a US port for 6 months afterwards, which would be a regular thing for a shipper. If there's a company from a different country that trades with Cuba or uses Cuban sugar or nickel, the United States government will say either you can trade with us or trade with them. Of course, the U.S. is a much larger trading partner than Cuba, a tiny island of about 11.5 million. If there's one little part, for example, in a pacemaker that's made in Germany, this German pacemaker that Cuba used to get for their healthcare system from Germany started using a tiny U.S. part. After that, it could not be traded with Cuba. So all these things are just so strangling for Cuba in terms of damaging their economy and also making it really difficult for Cubans to get the medicines that they need or educational supplies or construction supplies and things like that.
These kind of difficulties and complications beg the question, well, why? I mean, why would the United States government do this to the Cuban people? The confusion is even deeper than that. A lot of times people, when they find out that I'm going to Cuba or I've been to Cuba, an immediate question is, well, and they let you in? And are you going to be safe there? Kind of the assumption is that the repression is on the Cuban end of things, but it's the United States government that is enforcing this blockade. Why they do that is because basically Cuba is an example of a people who have decided to get out from beneath the thumb of United States foreign policy. Before the revolution in 1959, Cuba was, in essence, plantation, casino, whorehouse economy. The Cuban people were debased and impoverished. They were dispossessed. So much misery. It's almost unbelievable. But they had had enough, and that explains why the people that led the revolution, Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, and those with a handful of individuals, were able to go up against this very sophisticated military machine that was keeping the dictatorship in place, and they were able to go up against them and eventually win because they had the majority of the Cuban people with them. They took power into their own hands and have been very steadfast in that. They've just been tenacious in saying, we won't go back to the old slave plantation. We will not do that. We're going to go another way, independence and autonomy. So they set a dangerous example to a lot of the people in power in Washington, D.C., and also to the former elites in the old Cuba who left and now kind of populate the centers of power in places like Miami. So that's why. I mean, it's an organized effort. Ever since Cubans decided to take their lives into their own hands, there's been this concerted effort to undo all that. Since 59, they've just been leading the way and showing the world that another world is possible. Well, yeah. Exactly. All you have to do is go to Cuba and you can see that other world, or an example of another world, which is not just possible, but it is happening. It's unfolding, and it's a very beautiful thing. And that is the example that Washington, D.C. and the former elites of Cuba would like to see just squashed. It's been quite vicious. A lot of people have lost their lives. Pastures for Peace is all about trying to shine a spotlight on all that and do what we can in opposition to the squashing of the Cuban Revolution.
Something I wanted to bring up, like just after you have what you were saying, is despite this crippling blockade, they've been able to do so much in so many different fields, and it just makes you think, like, what could Cuba do if there wasn't this blockade?
Exactly.
Cuba has, despite the fact that they can't get so many medicines, that their healthcare system is suffering because of the blockade, they've developed this amazing preventative medicine shouldn't that be the way it is? That it's not that you get sick and you see a doctor, it's that you stay healthy so that you don't develop health problems that will cost thousands of dollars of care, that you prevent them. Cuba's developed that with things like regular doctor visits. There's 150 people for each doctor in Cuba. Doctors live in the community, they do house calls, they go around visiting the elderly. Cuba has developed green medicine. That's been a way that they can cope with the fact that there's so much medicines that they can't get. And so now you're seeing this country, which is a poor third world country, that has a better child mortality rate than the United States. That also in conjunction with the high levels of education, I mean, you can get a free education up to a PhD in Cuba. They've now developed, as a third world country, they've developed the problems of a developed first world country, where they don't have enough people in their workforce because people are having less kids, because they're spending more time doing education, and also people are getting older and living longer, and in the category of older people who are not working anymore. And it's just really kind of fascinating the way that Cuba's developed this kind of strange and difficult anomaly of a first world country because of their healthcare and education system being so advanced. But also, you know, everything from arts, like Cuba has one of the best ballet companies in the world. They have such amazing musicians and painters and artists.
Poets.
Yes, poets. Ooh. It's both educationally and medically, but also culturally. Cuba has so much to share with the world that this blockade is putting a stop on.
We're deprived in the United States of all that, just to talk about the cultural aspect of it. You know, how many people on the streets in the United States even know a Cuban poet? The only Cuban, you know, musicians that people know about are the ones coming out of Miami that basically are in some way or another associated with the old regime, and they get that message. But that side of it, yeah, it's an amazing thing that we are, you know, deprived of all the beautiful things that you do see when you go to Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Cuba really does have this kind of spirit of wanting to share with the world. I think they've realized that they've developed this very superior healthcare system and that the world is in the need of healthcare. And that's why Cuba has 20,000 doctors that are doing volunteer work around the world. Like, for example, in Haiti, even before the earthquake, there were doctors helping 10 years before the earthquake, and then they sent more after the earthquake. And in Pakistan, after the earthquake there, Cuba sent doctors. Cuba even offered doctors to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, which was an offer that the United States government ignored. I think this is just those amazing things that we don't hear about in the United States or Canada. I have to add the Canada in because that's where I'm from.
The examples just go on and on. You know, the organic agriculture, locally produced, you know, which is catching on in a big way in North America. In Cuba, they've been doing this for a long time, and they have that down to a science. And I think that to the point that now most, if not all, of the produce that's consumed in the city of Havana, which is a big city. How many people live in Havana? Do you know? It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a big city. All the produce consumed is produced locally within the city and organically, because when their economy, they lost like 70% of it with the collapse of the Soviet Union back in the early 90s, and so they weren't able to get the petroleum products and the pesticides and all that stuff, so they had to go back to finding other ways, older ways, and a lot of times it's even going back to oxen in the fields, and they didn't have the fuel and they couldn't even transport stuff from the countryside, so they started growing it in the city, and it's a beautiful thing. It's amazing. They're finding all kinds of ways to do things without the chemical intensive conventional way of doing things. The more we can find out and see that's happening in Cuba, the better for us. They're really showing an example. Years ago, I remember as a little kid, my dad used to have a little tiny, almost postage stamp size newspaper clipping that he kept, like a little icon or something, in his wallet. He showed it to me when I was very young. And it was something that somehow slipped through the major media, but there it was, a little tiny article. Some reporter asking an anonymous Cuban about 1960 or so, well, what about this revolution? What has it done for you? This Cubano said, we have shoes. We have shoes now, man. You know, on the face of it, to a lot of people, like, well, so what? But they didn't have shoes before. And then I came to find out later, many years later, that that was a serious problem, because a lot of the kids in Cuba before the revolution were afflicted with parasites that would actually enter the body through the soles of feet in the ground, in the dirt, and they would be parasite-ridden little kids. Very soon into the revolution, we have shoes, and this guy was overjoyed with that. It's just kind of a little, in a nutshell, the Cuban Revolution has done so much for the people of Cuba. I just wish people in my country could see that example.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the blockade, but another way that the United States has been definitely attacking Cuba and harming Cuba is through supporting and funding anti-Cuban terrorists, like the ones that Hap was talking about, people from the old dictatorship left Cuba for the U.S. and now live in Miami and were part of the kind of rich upper class dictatorship before the revolution and wants Cuba to go back to the way it was before, as Hap described, before 1959. So these terrorist groups, with full support of the United States government, of the CIA, have caused the deaths of about 3,500 people in Cuba through things like hotel bombings, which actually killed an Italian-Canadian tourist and many Cubans and other people. But being from Canada, I know especially an Italian-Canadian tourist in the 90s that bombed a Cuban airliner in 1976, killing all 73 people on board, including the Cuban fencing team. What a huge, huge tragedy that, you know, most people here in the United States don't know about, this huge plane bombing.
That was the first one too, wasn't it?
I think it was the first.
It set the example of, this is how you commit acts of terror in the skies. It was the anti-Cuban revolution terrorists that did that.
Yeah, and so this, very well known to the United States government, is Luis Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch, who are two of the kind of masterminds of a lot of these terrorist attacks, which, beyond what I just said, also include livestock poisoning and the introduction of diseases in Cuba. They have openly said that, yeah, we were behind this plane bombing. Yet they were still, or are still, living freely in the United States. Orlando Bosch died recently of natural causes, but he was not brought to justice. And Luis Posada Carriles is living in the United States, despite the fact that Venezuela has filed for extradition for Luis Posada Carriles because he was facing trial in Venezuela and escaped to the United States. But recently, Luis Posada Carriles, this man who has publicly said, yes, I committed terrorist acts against Cuba, he went to trial in the United States not for the terrorist crimes, but because he lied about his terrorist activities while entering the United States. So not for the terrorist activities, but because he lied about them. And he was still let off for this and is living freely in the United States, which is totally criminal, because at the same time as these two men that we're just talking about that have committed all these crimes, have killed all these people in Cuba, at the same time as they're totally free in the United States, in a country that says they're fighting a war on terror, there's five Cuban men, anti-terrorist fighters, who were sent by Cuba to infiltrate and investigate these anti-Cuban terrorist groups. They're in jail, and this happened back in 98, or a few years before that. They had gone to the United States. They sent the information they found back to Cuba to be able to defend themselves, but also this information was shared with the United States government, and basically saying, okay, this is what's going on in your country. These are terrorist groups that are committing these acts. Do something about it. And of course, the United States government turned around and put these five men in jail. They were in solitary confinement for 17 months before they were even tried. And then they had a total kangaroo court trial in Miami, which is a very biased venue against anyone who is coming from Cuba who's in support of the Cuban government. They were put in jail for a total, collectively, of 4 life sentences plus 77 years on charges like conspiracy to commit espionage. Not attempted espionage, not committing espionage, but all these lifetime sentences were put on them for conspiracy to commit espionage, which is with no evidence. These five men have been in jail now for 13 years. They've been under horrible conditions. Two of them have not been able to see their wives. Their wives have time after time been denied a visa to enter the United States to visit their husbands. These are five men who need to be free, and that people in the United States don't know about, because there's been a total media blackout about this case. people in the United States need to know about these five men, and they need to demand their freedom because these are political prisoners. These are anti-terrorist fighters that are languishing in jail.
Something to think about is they were not engaged in any kind of espionage or any kind of spying activities against the United States government. But if the U.S. government is claiming that that's what they were doing, when in fact they had infiltrated and were spying on these terrorist groups based in Miami, then by logical extension, the United States is engaged in those terrorists. There's a connection there. These guys were spying on that terrorist activity, and the United States claims that they were spying on them. They're almost admitting to the connection. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, another important thing about the case of these five Cuban men is pretty much all of the legal options have been exhausted. Right now, what the families and the lawyers will tell you is that it's really up to the solidarity movement. It's really up to people, especially in the United States, to work for the freedom of these five men and put pressure on the United States government to release them. There's been 12 Nobel Prize winners who've demanded the freedom of these Cuban Five. There's a campaign started because now Obama is a Nobel Peace Prize winner, somehow. These 12 Nobel Prize winners are saying, okay, we've said we want the freedom of the Cuban Five. We're Nobel Prize winners. Obama, where's your signature? Because with a stroke of a pen, he could free the Cuban Five. Mm. And right now, there are 300 committees all around the world demanding freedom for the Cuban Five. And so it's really something people can get involved with. A lot of these committees are throughout the United States. People in the United States have the most influence to be able to change the situation and free the Cuban Five.
So again, Janine, here we are in Olympia, Washington, and heading south on the west coast leg of the caravan, city and town to town. And it's something that anybody listening to this can get involved in. Good place to begin if you have online access to go to pastorsforpeace.org. Check us out. It's been going on for 20-some years now. IFCO Pastors for Peace has been involved in all kinds of solidarity work in Latin America, Chiapas, in Haiti and Honduras and places like that. It's been happening for a long time. So there's a wealth of information and historical perspective in this movement. There's an organization in Seattle that a lot of people know about called El Centro de la Raza, the Center of the Human Family. It's a Chicano Latino-based community organization. One of the founders, the late executive director and a very, very close companion of mine, Roberto Maestas, was very involved in Cuba. He saw the Cuban example as something to pay attention to and to emulate. So there are even examples here and there in the United States, El Centro being one of them, that basically kind of modeled on the Cuban example. He used to say that El Centro, just right there in Beacon Hill, Seattle, Washington, was a little tiny Cuba, a little island of autonomy, independence, and self-determination. People that are going to do what they need to do for their own people. He's the one who basically said, "Hap, you got to go. You got to go to Cuba, you know. Enough talking about it, enough getting it secondhand. You got to go." And he made it possible for me to do that back in 2009. Don't see myself ever stopping going to Cuba. I think it's going to be something I'm going to want to do ongoingly for a long time. And a lot of us in Pastors for Peace say, yeah, we'll just keep doing this until the blockade is over. Hopefully we don't have to do it this way very much longer, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. There's kind of joke that the caravans are a bit addictive. I mean, you go on one and it's just such an amazing experience. I'll definitely say it's one of the best experiences of my life. And that's why I'm going for the second consecutive year now. But some people have been doing this, all 22 caravans, 17 caravans, 5 caravans. But it's an opportunity to travel through the United States and meet people who are interested in social justice and creating a better world. It's an opportunity to stand up for something that's right and openly defy a policy which is damaging other human beings and our fellow brothers and sisters in Cuba. It's an opportunity to see this island nation that Hap and I have been raving about and have a million nice things to say about. There's a lot of ways that people can get involved. Again, if you go to Pastors for Peace, www.pastorsforpeace.org, you can do everything from getting on the bus with us. We travel on brightly painted yellow school buses, or sometimes they're painted different colors, and they're painted with slogans like Free the Cuban Five or Lift the Blockade on Cuba. Cuba, which makes for a lot of really good and interesting discussions along the road with people you meet. But you can join us on the bus. You can come along with us. You can come and be part of breaking the blockade on Cuba. You can get involved in hosting one of the caravan events as we stop in your city. You can, if you decide you want to host the caravan as it comes through your city and get your friends and family and community together to hear what these people have to say, you can do that. And also a really big thing is the financial contributions, because it does cost a lot of money to do this huge project. And again, on pastorsforpeace.org, you can see how you can contribute financially. A really amazing thing about the caravan is seeing Cuba, and just it comes down to all those little things and all those times where you meet Cubans and just, you know, you're on the side of a street somewhere, walking down the street, and you get into a conversation with a Cuban and you ask them a whole bunch of questions and they're so willing to talk and to explain their lives and their experience, especially to U.S. citizens. U.S. citizens, when they go down to Cuba, receive a lot of warmth and a lot of appreciation, because they know that there's a difference between the government of the United States and people in the United States.
Absolutely.
And they feel very appreciative to American citizens that are taking that risk to defy the blockade and see Cuba for themselves. We've just had the opportunity to let people know about this amazing trip, to let people know about why we're going to openly defy and break the U.S. blockade on Cuba. In the end, people who are listening, it's there for you to see and get involved in and find a place in it. All the information for this project is on pastorsforpeace.org. We kind of need to get going.
COA 106.5 would like to continue providing our community with sensible, independently produced public affairs shows, bringing underreported information similar to this interview to the public. COA 106.5 is a non-commercial station, therefore donations are our main source of revenue. Currently, COA 106.5 is seeking financial and material support. We also need more volunteers to help us operate the community radio station. You can contact us at coa@riseup.net or call us at 360-352-1646. Financial donations for COA 106.5 should be sent to Media Island International, P.O. Box 7187, Olympia, Washington, 98507. And our PayPal account is located at mediaisland.org. We hope you enjoyed an interview with the 22nd Cuba Caravanistas 2011. The opinions voiced on this program are not the opinions of Media Island International or KOWA 106.5 LPFM. This is a KOWA 106.5 LPFM production. This program is available for distribution for non-commercial use only.